Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The second week of the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin begins today. Here is some of what we've heard so far.
It's been nights. I stayed up apologizing and apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more and not physically interacting and not saving his life.
That was Darnella Frazier, the then 17-year-old, who took the cell phone video of Chauvin with his knee on George Floyd's neck. Charles McMillan, who was also at the scene of Floyd's death, broke down after rewatching video of the arrest in court.
I feel helpless. I don't have a mama either. I understand him. My mom died June 25th.
Christopher Martin, the teenage store clerk who accepted what he believed to be a fake $20 bill from Floyd, which later led to his coworker calling 911, he was asked what was going through his mind as he watched George Floyd being taken away in an ambulance.
Disbelief and guilt.
Why guilt?
If I would have just not taken the bill, this could have been avoided.
The ripple effects of Floyd's death are long, deep, and lasting. So today, we're going to talk about bearing the trauma of bearing witness. And we'll start with Tim Marango. He's correspondent for the New York Times, and he's been covering the Chauvin trial in Minneapolis. Tim, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi, Meghna. I'm glad to be here.
So first of all, this trial is being televised, so people are able to see it as it unfolds in real time. But watching it flattened into two dimensions is an entirely different thing than being in the courtroom. So can you describe to us a little bit about how the mood of the, what was the mood inside the courtroom during that first week of testimony?
Yeah, so we work in the media on a pool basis, and so every day there's a seat for the print or digital media, and we rotate by news organization. So I was there, yes, last Wednesday when Mr. McMillan testified. And, you know, I think the best way to describe the atmosphere is just the intensity of it and this feeling of heaviness. I feel like everybody in the room, and it's very limited because of the pandemic. There are two spectator seats, one for the Floyd family and one for the Chauvin family, and two journalist seats for the broadcast and print digital, and that's it for spectators. So everybody is spread out, and it's just an immense, you know, emotion and intensity in that room, because I think everybody understands the gravity of what they're doing, what they're being a part of.
So on that day when Mr. McMillan testified, were you able to see sort of how the jury was absorbing that testimony, or even how George Floyd's family or Derek Chauvin himself?
Yeah, absolutely. So my seat is on one side of the room, and I'm facing directly to the jury, the 14 people, and they're facing sort of me. And, you know, everyone has a mask on, and so it's hard to discern, you know, their facial expressions, but they all – every person was obviously watching this very intensely, and many were taking notes. Mr. Floyd's brother, Rodney Floyd, his youngest brother, was in the courtroom that day, and he was sitting to my right, and then to my left, about the same distance, maybe 15 or 20 feet, is Derek Chauvin. And so I was trying to watch Rodney Floyd's reactions as he watched this video again and again, and it's hard to watch. Hard to watch him. For me, because he has to sit there and sort of re-experience this trauma with the person who's accused of you know, murdering his brother sitting 20 feet away.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
You know, there's obviously 10,000 different questions to be asked about even week one of the trial. But as you heard, we're focusing today on what seemed to us to be this very strong pattern of still continuing personal pain as evidenced by the testimony that we heard. Was that you know, sort of a frequent expression that witnesses gave last week?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And I had been in Minneapolis. I came in January to sort of prepare myself for the trial, and I had been there for a couple of weeks before the trial started. And when I was out talking to people around town, activists, people in the community, people around George Floyd Square, time and time again, this is before the trial started, I heard the word trauma, that the trauma is so deep, not just from the death of George Floyd, but from other cases of police brutality that Minneapolis has never really dealt with. And I just heard again and again the trauma. And so when I heard all those witnesses, my first thought was these witnesses and what they're saying is sort of representative and an expression of the trauma of an entire city and community, I feel like.
Mm. Well, Tim, hang on here for just a moment, because I'm going to come back to you in a minute to talk about just a little bit about what to expect for this week. But since you did mention the community at large, I'd like to now turn to Suzette Hackney, who's joining us from Minneapolis as well, national columnist and editorial board member for USA Today. Suzette, welcome.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you for having me.
So you've been speaking to members of the community in Minneapolis. What have you been hearing from them?
Absolutely. I'm not here to cover the trial. I'm really here to embed into the community and talk to folks about what they're experiencing here. And it's been heartbreaking. You know, the word trauma, as Tim mentioned, is truly, this community is truly traumatized. There's so much grief there. And it's been something they've been experiencing since May 25th. And now they're just reliving it all. They're being re-traumatized every day that this trial goes on.
Mm. And yet, That's the necessary fallout of a trial happening, right? I mean, so how are people sort of balancing those two truths together? They are experiencing this re-traumatizing, but it's because, you know, a trial is actually going on, which is an essential step towards however the jury is going to define justice.
Yes, and they're absolutely glued to their televisions. They're watching every single moment of this. And it's difficult. It's difficult for journalists to see it. It's difficult for this community at large, but they are very invested. And so they want to watch it. It's like they can't look away, but it's very painful as well. And, you know, this comes where we all saw that video last year. But we're seeing it from all the angles. We're seeing the body cam footage now. We're hearing Derek Chauvin's voice after they've taken George Floyd away, describing what happened. I mean, all of those things that we are just now learning are also re-traumatizing.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been spending time at George Floyd Square, and what are people telling you? I'm just trying to get specifically sort of how are folks processing this moment?
Well, there's a lot of apprehension here. There is a lot of fear of disappointment if Chauvin is acquitted. And there's this, and it really saddens me. I have not come across one person yet who is not thinking that there will be an acquittal. They're already, they've told me time and time again, history has shown us that we don't get convictions. We don't get convictions when Black men are killed by police. And so, you know, it's that idea that, well, we'll be pleasantly surprised if it happens, but we're not counting on it. And that to me is very sad.
Hmm. Well, we are seeing the opening of the second week of the trial today. And Tim, notably, the current chief of police is testifying, Madaria Arredondo, who became chief of police, I believe, in 2017 in in Minneapolis, fifth generation Minnesotan. Can you tell us what he's expected to say?
Yes, this will be another dramatic moment because it's another example of what's so different about this case. You don't normally see police officers disavowing one of their own, especially a police chief. And so he'll be on the stand. I'm told it could be most of the day, especially if the cross-examination goes long. And he'll talk about the policies and about, that this wasn't something police officers are taught to do.
Yeah, I believe it last year he was quoted in local media in Minneapolis as saying, quote, "Mr. George Floyd's tragic death was not due to a lack of training. The training was there. This was murder. It wasn't a lack of training." So he's expected to provide very powerful testimony, even as defense attorneys are trying to focus attention on Chauvin's training specifically.
We'll see what they do when they put on their case, and they'll have a use of force expert. But the chief's testimony today, combined with some of the police officers' testimony last week, disavowing this and saying this is not part of the training, you know, it seems like that's a huge hurdle for the defense to overcome in arguing that the use of force was in policy. I think the bigger central piece of the defense strategy, it will be the medical stuff and cause of death.
Yeah. Suzette, we've just got about 30 seconds before we have to take a quick break. I wondered if you wanted to comment on that.
Yes. The prosecutors certainly have put on a strong case. The witnesses were very strong last week. But as Tim mentioned, there is the defense. I think the fact that so many police officers are speaking up against Derek Chauvin is very...
I lost you there for a little bit, Suzette, but Tim Arango, I'm going to let you go here. He's a correspondent for The New York Times reporting from Minneapolis. Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
And by the way, Chief Arredondo, as I mentioned, is a fifth generation Minnesotan. He joined the Minneapolis Police Department in 1989 and the many layers of race and policing here. In 2007, he and four other African-American officers sued that very department, alleging discrimination in promotions, pays, and discipline, and the lawsuit was settled with the city for more than $700,000. And again, he was made chief in 2017. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And this hour, we are talking about bearing the trauma of bearing witness as the second week of the trial of former Minnesota police officer Derek Chauvin opens today. Last week, there was a lot of very powerful testimony. For example, here is Jenna Scurry, a Minneapolis 911 dispatcher. Jenna was the first witness to take the stand last week, and she alerted a police supervisor after she watched surveillance camera footage of officers pinning George Floyd to the ground. In court, she answered questions from prosecutor Matthew Frank about that footage.
I first asked if the screens had frozen.
Why did you ask that?
Because it hadn't changed.
Okay. And did you find that it had frozen?
No.
How did
well,
you
I was know? Told that it was not frozen.
Did you see the screen change yourself?
Yes, I saw the persons moving.
So what did you start thinking at that point?
Something might be wrong.
Why?
We don't get these videos often, or, you know, video at all, unless it's looking at the bridge or just looking at people walking. We very rarely get incidents where police are actively on a scene. And they had changed. They had come from the back of the squad to the ground, and my instincts were telling me that something's wrong. Something has not right. I don't know what, but something wasn't right.
Jenna Scurry, a Minneapolis 911 dispatcher, testifying last week. I'm joined today by Suzette Hackney, national columnist and editorial board member for USA Today. She's in Minneapolis. Joining us now from Atlanta is Rose Scott, host of Closer Look with Rose Scott on WABE Atlanta's NPR station. Rose, welcome back to the show. See if we can get Rose actually back on the show here in just a second. So let me turn now to Gary Bailey, Assistant Dean for Community Engagement and Social Justice and Professor of Practice at Simmons University School of Social Work. Professor Bailey, welcome to you.
Thank you very much, Meghna. How are you?
Well, I suppose the larger question is, how are we all doing, right? How is this nation doing at this moment, and particular communities? So let me ask you the same question I'd asked Suzette earlier. Over the course of the week, how are you first processing the beginning of this trial?
Exhausted, emotionally exhausted. When we look at the intersectional issues that are confronting us as individuals and as a society, people refer to the racial reckoning. I call it, for some, a racial awakening. The COVID pandemic, a year plus of being faced with health disparities disproportionately affecting Black and Brown communities, anti-Asian violence occurring on the streets of our country, it is overwhelming. And then followed by the trial and the re-traumatization of this event that brings up so many others. I've been thinking about Emmett Till for some reason this week, who was killed the year I was born. And so that arc is something that's not lost on me. And Trayvon Martin and Tamir Rice, Botham Jean, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, all of my trans sisters who've been killed and whose names we don't know. It's just overwhelming.
You know, in one of the in the early days after Mr. Floyd's death, we had on the show a guest who put it this way, and it stayed with me ever since then. You know, he said, "What America witnessed was a 21st century, gosh, it's even hard to say the word, but 21st century lynching."
Yes,
and that is one of the reasons why the trauma of, first of all, the ripple effects of that trauma will last quite some time, and I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, I think that it's an interesting analogy, and to connect them. I always want to elevate lynchings as the horrendous, sadistic acts that they were, and not to minimize the power of lynchings, and also not to fool ourselves into a false sense of security. Lynchings are still happening in this country. And so I just want to be able to name that. But this is something that has happened in front of our very eyes, both in some ways is touching for communities of color, particularly Black folks, historical trauma. We know the stories of people in our own families who have been lynched. We know the silence around those deaths and what that all means. And also we know that there are people who stood around those trees and watched and participated as if it were a theater. And so that's also something that we know, is that there's not the faceless innocence who can claim to say that they didn't know.
Tell me more about what you mean about youth thinking some people participated in as if it was theater.
Well, when you look at pictures of lynchings, if we go back and really talk about lynchings, a late friend of mine who is a social work historian, collected lynching postcards. Pictures were taken, postcards were sent. It was an event. It was something that communities participated in. Word went out that this was going to happen. And so the act of taking someone's life and torturing violating someone's basic humanity was something that was part of the process of lynching. And I would argue that Chauvin and others like him, be it Mike Brown's body being left in the public on the public street for hours in Ferguson, or Chauvin just casually sitting with a knee on someone's throat, were also part of that kind of performance, if you will, the taking of Black lives in public spaces.
Right. So I appreciate the clarification, Dean Bailey, because for a moment I thought you had mentioned that there were, you know, witnesses who had climbed trees around
the site of Mr.
Floyd's death. So I do appreciate the clarification. Thank you for that.
Yes.
I think we have Rose Scott from WABE connected now. Rose, you with us?
Yes, Meghna, can you hear me?
I can. It's great to have you back on the show. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Just jump in right here. What have you been thinking, feeling, reflecting on what both Dean Bailey and Suzette Hackney have been saying?
Well, I think they're both absolutely correct. I mean, to hear the dean talk about Emmett Till, you know, Meghna, this trauma of watching, you know, Black deaths go viral is nothing new for non-white groups in this nation, especially Black Americans. Let's just be really clear and honest about that. So for me, I remember vividly the first time I became aware of Emmett Till murdered in Mississippi in 1955. It will be decades later because my parents kept newspaper clippings and the Jet magazine that had that photo of Emmett Till in the casket. Mm-hmm. And for me to see that and then have my parents explain to me what that was all about, you know, we joke about it now a little bit in my family, but I remember when Roots, the miniseries, was on television and I was little and you know, it was a big event in my neighborhood in St. Louis. Everyone was going to watch Roots, you know, and I was probably about 6 or 7 years old and that was just a TV miniseries. But for me, I could not understand, you know, what was happening to people who look like me. So whether it's a TV miniseries or now we're talking about reality here, you know, how many times the Black community has had to relive Black deaths, and this is way before cell phones. So besides those in the courtroom, you know, those watching the trial, we're all reminded of this 9-minute-plus cell phone video, the cries from George Floyd, the pleas from onlookers, those that knew him, the expression on the officer's face while his knee is pressed into Floyd's neck. And as the dean put it, and I can't even begin to take it any further, but the dean was absolutely right. You know, this is an ongoing traumatic experience that so many folks in this, particularly Black folks in this nation, we've dealt with for more than a century now.
Mm-hmm. Well, Suzette Hackney, you've been patiently listening, and I want to pull you back in here and also just encourage the three of you to, you know, don't wait for me. Just definitely jump in and feel free to talk with each other, right? Because this is a conversation to hear how this trial and watching the trial is having an impact and what impact that is. So Suzette, just go ahead.
Yes. So here in Minneapolis, I mean, this is very personal for folks who live here. And this is not the first incident here. You know, you had Jamar Clark back in 2015. You had Philando Castile in 2016. He was killed in a nearby suburb. These are cases that folks have been screaming about for years. And then we land with George Floyd. And think about the context of that. As the dean said, you know, you had last summer Ahmaud Arbery, we had Breonna Taylor. There are just so many names. So many people are struggling to answer. How do we reconcile the abuse, mistreatment, and dehumanization of Black people? It's been going on for years, for decades, for centuries. And honestly, you know, these cases are opening the eyes of many people. And there are more folks who now recognize that there's a problem. It's now taking those steps to address the problem.
Mm-hmm. It's also interesting in the times that we're in to really to go deeper. And these are important conversations to have. And the trauma is real. And in Minneapolis, you have a great trauma specialist, social work specialist, Resma Menachem, who's been doing trauma-based work and particularly looking at racialized trauma. And he talks about the impact of racialized trauma. We're talking about 13, 14 generations, because when we really go back 400 plus years, we're talking about trauma that has been transmuted across generations. And it's really important to be able to name that it's just not this moment. It's the collective trauma of a people. And I look at that in light of Rachel Yehuda's work, her work around epigenetics, and really looking at the impact on Holocaust survivors of the Holocaust on their families, which has really been devastating to families. And it makes me think, okay, that's a moment in time that was horrific. What does that trauma look like over 400 years in this country? Mm. And so these moments that for others are I didn't know moment, for others are a soul-stirring, I've always known moment.
Yeah. Rose, did you want to reflect on that?
Yeah, I think folks, you know, to just carry on with the dean and what the other guests are saying, if folks don't understand what history is supposed to do, this is what history does, right? It reminds us not just of the great moments and the achievements, but of the horrors as well. And, you know, here I'm down in Atlanta, Georgia, where I've been almost for 30 years in my career and covering the issues with the new voting law and people understanding, well, what's the issue with that, you know, Ahmaud Arbery. Also, an Atlanta community that's still trying to come to terms with more than four decades ago why little Black boys and girls were killed and coming up missing. This is it's a continued process. And if folks don't understand how that is traumatic for a community, I don't know what more we can say or do to prove that.
And I would add to what Rose had just said, that we can't lose sight also, though this is not directly related with a solid line to the Chauvin case. And I think we need to name these what they are. This is really not the George Floyd case. This is a murder case against Chauvin, because that's the way because the way in which we label things really changes the gestalt and the essence of what we're talking about. But as we're looking at attacks and trying to do away with enfranchisement, the right to vote, really going after the sorts of things that people gave their lives for not that long ago in recent memory, and watching that under attack as well, all of this adds to the trauma. It's just not one thing. It's the cumulative nature of all of these things of being Black in America.
Mm. Suzette, what do you think?
I would add to that, you know, again, talking to folks here, one of the reasons George Floyd Square is still closed to the public is that, and when I mean close to the public, you can obviously walk in and come and look at the memorial and such, but there's a 4-block radius where Mr. Floyd died, and there are barricades up, and there are activists who intend on holding it down until there are 24 demands that are met. And a lot of those demands are things that folks have been crying for years, not just in this community, but in the nation. A reinvestment in community resources, meaning, you know, around jobs, job training, affordable housing, addiction treatment, which is very key in this case when you talk about George Floyd, and you talk about the use in drugs and how, you know, Black folks are sometimes stigmatized for addiction and criminalized for addiction. as opposed to white folks who are suffering from those same addictions. So these are things that folks want here. These are things that they're demanding here.
Mm-hmm. We have just about a minute and a half before we have to go to our next break here. But let me just ask quickly, is there I'll make this simpler. Dean Bailey, what do you think about the fact that this trial is being televised?
It's funny that you say that, Meghna. What's been going through my head is Gil Scott-Heron's "The Revolution Will Be Televised," and that's just been going through my head. I think it's important to be able to take this into people's homes, the same way that the marches in the 60s went into people's homes. So I get why it's important for people to bear witness. I also understand the cost of that bearing witness, just as I understand the cost that it took for those early protesters to be in the streets and the risk that they took. I think that we are a society that sometimes likes to pretend that we don't know things. And you cannot say that you aren't, you might choose not to know it, but you can't say that you weren't, it wasn't made available for you to be aware of what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we head into the break, we're getting some listener feedback here. Julianne on Facebook. Julianne says, "I'm not black and I find it traumatic. I can't imagine how it must feel to be black and witness this again and again and again." We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we're talking about the second week, or as the second week of the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin opens. We're talking about the trauma of re-witnessing the death of George Floyd and the bigger picture about this moment in America right now. And I'm joined today by Gary Bailey, Assistant Dean for Community Engagement and Social Justice and a professor of practice at Simmons University School of Social Work. Suzette Hackney joins us as well. She's a national columnist and editorial board member for USA Today. She's in Minneapolis. And Rose Scott is with us from Atlanta, host of Closer Look with Rose Scott on WABE. And I would just like to listen back again to another moment from last week's testimony, if we could. This is firefighter Genevieve Hansen. She was off duty when she witnessed officers arresting and hurting Floyd. And she testified last week that she pleaded to help George Floyd and described how she would have treated him had she been allowed to. Here she is answering questions from prosecutor Matthew Frank.
In my memory, I offered to walk them through it or told them, if he doesn't have a pulse, you need to start compressions. And that wasn't done either.
And so when it, well, are these things that you wanted to do?
It's what I would have done for anybody.
And when you couldn't do that, how did that make you feel?
Totally distressed.
Were you frustrated?
Yes.
Firefighter Genevieve Hansen testifying last week. Now, I just want to make something crystal clear here. There is a trial going on. Due process is happening in a courtroom in Minneapolis. So this hour, this discussion is not about the specifics of the trial in particular, because I believe in letting that system do its job, hopefully to the best of its ability. So we're having a bigger conversation about the ripple effects in the community in Minneapolis, and then further out across the rest of the country, especially this moment in history. And I just, Rose, you'll appreciate this as my fellow journalist here. I felt that it was important to make that distinction because I think sometimes it can often be thought that we're just presuming some things. And what I'm presuming is that it's necessary for us to have a conversation about how we as Americans move forward. So do you think that this moment is actually, is it different as the United States watches this trial than from many of the other trials or similarly what felt like should have been turning points regarding racial justice in this country?
I think it's different, Meghna, for a few reasons. One being, let's go back to last summer. Let's go back to all the protests and the calls for racial justice. Let's go back to how that not just only was demonstrated in this nation, but around the world. And keep in mind, during a pandemic. And then also, in keeping in line with what you just said, and I think it is important, because yes, we're talking, there is a trial taking place. But what I believe is also traumatizing for a lot of Black folks, and that's the anxiety that comes with whatever the ruling may be, because we've been down this road before. You know, we saw the video footage of Rodney King and the officers, and I may be dating myself here. Folks, figure out my age. I was in college when that verdict came down, and I remember the Black Student Union folks being so upset and immediately heading to one of the areas on campus, you know, to have a protest. So there's also that anxiety that comes with if the ruling isn't what folks want it to be, and then the aftermath of that. Mm.
Suzette, you're there in Minneapolis. You want to talk about that?
Absolutely. And I mentioned it before, there is just such a sense of dread here. There are two things at play. So the mayor and the police chief very much want to open George Floyd Square to reconnect it to the city. And they say it's for public safety reasons. As I described, there are volunteers and activists who just do not want that to happen right now. And so that is simmering here as well, because the mayor and the chief have pledged to do that. They said that there are residents in that area who very much want to see their city services return. They want to have the ability to come and go without, you know, having to go through checkpoints. They want to reclaim their neighborhood. And so there's that's simmering. And then there's the bigger picture of what's happening downtown just 3 miles away. And we have, you know, National Guards guarding the courthouse. And that will just be ramped up as this case continues. And so anxiety is just the word. Like, you can feel it. You can just feel it. It's just covered in the city. You know, folks say, we don't know what's going to happen if he's acquitted, but we know there's people will take to the streets. And so there's that concern, will there be riots? Will there be looting? Will there be mass protests, both here and throughout the nation, if there's not a conviction? None of us know what's going to happen. And I think there's that fear that's just really strangling this city.
Mm. Dean Bailey, go ahead.
Yeah, I would add here that what we have is evidence. And the evidence is we have enough examples over the last century of how the system doesn't work when it comes to justice, that the guilty do walk and get away with it, that the woman who bore false witness against Emmett Till and admitted that she did is still has never served a day in jail because it was determined that she was too old. We think of all the unnamed bodies that were lives that were taken during the civil rights movement, where people who were not found guilty or have ever been charged. So we have enough evidence to say that the justice system is not about justice. And that ultimately, I heard someone say the other day that it comes down to within the community, it being just us, just us. It's not about justice. It's about just us.
Well, I don't want to fall into the trap of viewing history through the most the narrowest of lenses, right? Because 1 year in the life of any nation, especially this nation, does not a historical moment make, right? Ripples take years to unfold for us to understand what really has changed, right? However, at the same time, I'm remembering all the conversations we hosted last year. Rose, I know you probably had even many more. Because of the national wave of response when Americans of all races saw what happened to George Floyd, something did feel palpably different. That perhaps if this is not a corner turned in America, at least maybe a couple of degrees of looking in a new direction. I mean, Dean Bailey, would you agree or disagree with that? And I'm asking because then the witnessing this trial is maybe the next step of perhaps another degree of making that turn.
Oh, I do agree, Magna. You know, I am someone who gets up every day looking towards hope, and I believe that all things are possible. And I think that we are in a time that this has been a perfect storm. I've never liked that term, mm-hmm. but I think this past year has been a perfect storm. We were shut down, forced to focus. The distractions, the noise that goes into so much of our lives and our communities and our world was ambient. And so people had the moment in time to focus on what was happening around them. And this incident, which is not alone and singular, but really is representative of a number of incidents. And I think it's a moment where young people who have benefited from discussions that their parents and grandparents heretofore have not had about white supremacy and misogyny and patriarchy and homophobia and all of the things that some generations make light of but are really part of who they are, and that they see the injustice and want to be part of the change. And so I do feel positively about what the opportunity that this is presenting, and I see this as being a different moment. However, I also, at 65 years old, know that I'm not going to see the change that I've been hoping for those 65 years in my lifetime.
Yeah, I think Dean is absolutely correct. How many times have we always said, okay, it's up to the next generation. It's up to the generation behind, you know, Gen Xers, millennials, and then Gen Z. So how many times are we going to expect this change to come with the new generation? But it's a holistic approach, whether it's through policy and from federal down to state onto local. It's going to take a holistic approach. And so that change that the dean talks about, you know, in his 65 years, and then the change that I'm expecting in my 51 years, we may not see it. We may not. But at some point, you know, I understand when that generation that's tasked with the change, when they say, you know what y'all have been doing was somewhat, you know, effective, but now we want to take it a different strategy. And then that's where you get into the whole across generations in terms of civil and human rights. You know, what's the strategy? What's the actionable outcome that we mm-hmm. want? So I understand both sides of all of that. Mm-hmm. Now, when will it happen? I simply don't know.
I do think it's important to remind people, though, you know, I know how traumatizing this all is for Black America, for everyone, but particularly for Black Americans. But I don't want anyone to look away. And I know that sounds crazy because it's, you know, it's very challenging to watch this trial. It's very challenging to listen to these witnesses testify and relive their own trauma. But we can't look away. White folks can't look away. You know, if there's anything that comes out of this, comes out of George Floyd's death and this trial, hopefully it's that there is more enlightenment. There are people who can now recognize policies need to be shifted. Action needs to be taken.
Dean Bailey, go ahead.
I think that this is a wonderful opportunity for us to really plant the trees that will bear fruit for future generations. That old saying is, none of us eat the fruit of the trees from the trees that we've planted. And so it is moving this forward. Those of us, and I do think it's an intergenerational moment. It is not time for me to lead, but it is to be there to be supportive with people thinking about the strategies for who do we want to be when we come out of this. I'm telling my students that as we emerge from this moment, this pandemic moment, as I look historically, you know, we emerged in 1918 into the Roaring Twenties and into the Progressive Era and made some of the most radical progressive shifts that have ever happened in the country that are now part of our infrastructure. So who do we want to be going forward as we emerge from this? Because that's where it's really important to be able to put the energy. And I also want to say to my Black, Brown brothers, sisters, and family who are out there, that it's also important for us to hold on to our joy, that amidst the trauma, that we still also have to hold on to the joy, because it's the joy that energizes us and gets us up and keeps us going. That's what fed the souls of the ancestors. And we're now the ancestors, and we have to feed those souls for the future.
Mm. You know, I really appreciate the fact that we're able to hold multiple things in this conversation, you know, a keen focus on this moment, but also this long historical lens, because that's giving me the room to ask a question. Dean Bailey, you said earlier that you're worried or saddened maybe that the change that you hope for may not come within your lifetime. And yet at the same time, I heard you say and acknowledge that over the many centuries of U.S. history, there has been change, hard won, hard fought and hard won, but there has been. Progress has been made. So what change is it that you're hoping for now that you're fearful may not come?
That we stay in the moment of moving forward. You know, if we look at the data, it's very interesting to look at the data and to look at support for Black Lives Matter at the height of the summer and to look at the waning support for Black Lives Matter, particularly as we look at issues of race and losing the kind of support from certain segments of the white population, that it's going to be really important for those allies. If it were up to Black people to change this, it would have been changed 400 years ago. It's not up to us to change it.
Mm. Well, we've just got about, sorry, forgive me for interrupting there, Dean Bailey, but we've just got about a minute and a half left, and I wanted to give both Suzette and Rose a chance to share their last thoughts. Suzette, go ahead.
Yes, I mean, I think the dean is absolutely right. As social movements go, this is something that we have to continue pushing. But there are bright spots, you know, when we think about the civil rights movement, that, you know, pushed more Black folks to get involved in politics. We're seeing that still play out today. That needs to continue. There's no sitting on the sidelines. And I don't just mean that for Black people. I mean that for white people as well. The only way that we're going to address these systemic changes that are needed is that we're all on board. We're all moving toward that goal.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rose, in the last minute, I'm going to give you the last thought for today.
Yeah, let's move beyond the question of how can I be an ally, and let's get into how can I be part of the change. Because to say, how can I be an ally, you're just beginning by asking a question and then what? Do the work. If you're going to be woke, as I said before in this program, if you're going to be woke in the right way.
Hmm. Well, Rose Scott is host of Closer Look with Rose Scott on WABE Atlanta's NPR station. Rose, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Suzette Hackney, national columnist and editorial board member for USA Today, speaking to us from Minneapolis. Suzette, thank you so much.
Thank you, Magna.
And Gary Bailey, Assistant Dean for Community Engagement and Social Justice and Professor of Practice at Simmons University School of Social Work. Dean Bailey, pleasure to have you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits, so you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.